Good afternoon. I'm Jerry Hyman. I'm the president of the HILS Program on Governance here at CSIS. Those of you who watched the debates last night probably begin to get familiar with the topic. Unlike Iraq, the debate about the pace of withdrawal and how to complete a reasonably successful transition, which is what the Iraq debate is about, the debate about Afghanistan is really quite different. We're meeting at a fairly timely moment on this subject. The administration has begun a review of the its Afghanistan policy. Of course, not too much left in the administration, so what that review will look like is uncertain. General McKiernan, commander of the NATO forces, has asked for 15,000 to 30,000 more troops in Afghanistan. As you know, candidate Senator Obama wants to move troops from Iraq to Afghanistan. The British are pessimistic, claim that they see a pretty bleak future. And in the U.S. Election, although the reduction in Iraq is likely to go forward no matter who wins, the one in Afghanistan is almost likely surely going to go up no matter who wins. There are two areas, obviously, of contention or concern in Afghanistan. One is the security dimension, the regrouping and reassertion of Taliban forces from a point when they were really decimated last year to now where they are active force, now well-organized, effective, and instead of writing little slips of papers, are apparently quite well-versed in email, internet, all kinds of other things. So it's not your uncle's Taliban anymore. They now control the countryside at night, large parts of it at night, even if U.S. troops are in there in the daytime. So those of us up on this side of the audience can remember where the same thing was said about Vietnam, with not such pleasant results either. But the second area, and that's not the area we want to talk about today, not the security dimension, the second area is the governance dimension in Afghanistan. And here the question is whether everybody, including obviously the government of Afghanistan, needs to revisit the basic structures that were agreed about in Bonn in 2001. That led to the Loya Jirgas and the supposed national consensus on the basic forms of the state. Instead, what we seem to have now is a fair amount of corruption, ineffective institutions, president who is accused anyway by a fair number of people of being not only ineffective but nepotistic and building patronage regimes, and yet having to deal with a whole variety of other tribal and other actors who are more powerful, perhaps even than he is, supposedly to have represented the Pashtuns, but there seems to be some question about whether that is the case at all. Under some views, the government controls only about 30%, or its writ runs in only about 30% of the country, the Taliban about 10%, and the rest of it is up for grabs or under the control of tribals. So what do you do here? Are we losing? Is the fight being lost in Afghanistan? Is it a downward cycle, unlike Iraq? Can we realistically talk about any kind of success? What would it look like? And what things need to be done to get us there, particularly on the governance side, at least for today? With us today to discuss these issues and Ambassador Ron Newman, who served as ambassador, had a variety of offices earlier. His biography's on the backside of your program. Was ambassador to Algeria between 1994 and 97, to Bahrain in 2001 to 2004. He was with the Coalition Provisional Authority in 2004, and then ambassador to Afghanistan from 2005 to 2007, which, however, was not his first trip to Afghanistan. His father was U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, and he grew up, or at least a good hunk of his time, in a kindler, gentler, to quote the first President Bush, time in Afghanistan and has been back many, many times. And for him, at least, Afghanistan is close to his heart, not just to his profession. And secondly, Arnaud de Borchgrave, who has covered 18 wars, apparently. So he must have been with Thucydides in the Peloponnesus, because I don't know how many wars there are, how far you have to go back to get 18 wars. But senior editor of Newsweek for 25 years, editor-in-chief of the Washington Times, author of many, many articles in many, many places, and a person quite well connected and into Afghanistan and the actors in Afghanistan and the actors who affect Afghanistan outside it. So Ambassador Newman will make some initial remarks, and then Arnaud will make some additional remarks, and then we'll open up for Q's and A's. So thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you, Jerry. Let me see. I'll stay here if I can see everybody around the corner here, but I don't like to speak to people silently. That's good. I was glad that we ended up with this title, Linking Security and Governance. And I will try to focus primarily on the governance question as much as anything, because that's what Jerry asked me to do. But I think the title captures something, that is, security is related. In fact, really, when we try to pull apart governance or drugs or security, military peace, this is like pulling apart strands in a rope to look at the texture of a strand. But the rope and the strength of the rope is a function of all the strands being woven together. And one should not misunderstand the analytical looking at one function for the reality of the work, which has to go on in all parts. And in fact, security is a part of governance. As I was asking myself, you know, if you're an Afghan, what are the components that you regard as utterly key? We tend to have these boxes, and they come from living in a comparatively stable world. So we think of governance as, you know, what is bad governance? The trash wasn't picked up on time. The damn county won't answer the telephone to tell them about a pothole in the road. You know, it's services. When you live in a world where you're not sure if you're going to stay alive, your perspective's a little different. And I think, without trying to claim an Afghan's awareness, that I would list first and foremost security. Can I go to bed at night expecting to wake up alive in the morning without myself and my family having been molested? If the government cannot do that for me, then the government, there is no governance. Nothing else, you know, dead, the rest doesn't count. So security is an integral part of governance, and it's a part at which we have not done well, in which we have not resourced for a variety of reasons. I mean, we didn't put enough foreign troops. We built initially with a construct of much too small and too lightly equipped an Afghan army, and we tried to take a lot of militia commanders and their local loyalists, not to say in some cases thugs, and treat them as a national police force which could become of service to the nation by better uniforms, better equipment, and better training. But better equipped, trained thugs remain thugs. And the transition to a national police force is much, much harder. So security is number one. The second thing, right behind it, that Afghans look for in a government, I think, and you know, there's some people here who know as much more than I do about Afghanistan sitting in the audience, so you're welcome to stand up and talk. But I think the second thing is a sense of justice, which I would put really bracketed with fairness. When we talk about a judicial system, we tend to go in our minds, sort of without reflective thinking, to an Anglo-Saxon construct, to a construct of rules, and are the rules followed? That is not so much an Afghan mentality, particularly if it runs up against ethnic splits and tribal issues. You know, we encountered this when we were trying to apply the standards for disarming people to the candidate lists in Parliament. Well, you know, there were cases where, yes, the rule says we got to disqualify the guy because he's got armed retainers. On the other hand, if we disqualify him, a very large piece of a tribe will have no representation whatsoever in a province. And their reaction to that is scarcely going to be that this is just or fair because the rules were followed. So there's some balancing that has to take place. But it is the sense that you get a fair deal. It's not a sense that evidence is presented in an Anglo-Saxon fashion or maybe even a French fashion, but that there is fair justice, that justice is not simply the prerogative or protection is not only the prerogative of the followers and retainers of somebody who holds power, but is available more broadly. Now, this has never prevailed in all of Afghanistan. That's why tribal shuras and the like have been very popular, aside from the fact they work better than the courts. But there was a long period, comparatively long period, where the courts were reasonably respected and prestigious, at least in the capital and the main cities. That, too, does not exist now. And the third thing that I think Afghans talk about, maybe it's up there sort of with justice, is the development, is the services. Where that rates on their list of priorities, I think, is very dependent on the relative security around them. If they've got things aren't too bad, then everybody's talking about, I don't have my school, I don't have my road, I need my water project. And the list is enormous, so that the common view of most Afghans is that nothing is happening. That means if I don't have something of direct relevance to me, it's not happening. Doesn't mean that you haven't built the 500 schools or the 600 clinics or the 1,500 kilometers of roads that have been constructed up to now or a lot of other things that have happened. It means you're not reaching the threshold of expectation. I saw that once. A friend told me he was driving with an Afghan friend from Lashkargarh to the Ring Road on the newly paved branch road that we had built. And the friend said, you haven't done anything in Afghanistan. And he said, well, what about the road we're driving on? And he said, well, aside from this road, you haven't done anything. I think that captured a spirit. Okay, so where are we on these security, justice, development? I want to really spend most of the remaining time talking about how and how difficult. So I don't want to do a lot of the sort of status report, which I think is common, but it is not good. Security has degenerated considerably. It was not good when I was there. We predicted a bloody 2007. I suppose you could say that there's something good about having your predictions be right. 2008 is certainly going to be bloody. But there is an Afghan sense that security is getting worse. A lot of this is about psychology. It is about whether or not people feel they are on a downward slide or an upward slide. It is not about whether your metric says something or not. It's about what Afghans feel in their gut. And their gut tells them this is not going well, that the roads are far less secure than there were 2 years ago, and they're right. I drove to Wardak province. I'm quite sure the ambassador's security detail, even if I were the ambassador and I push the envelope a little bit sometimes, I'm sure I would not be driving to Wardak. Nobody's driving to Ghazni. Most people in my mission were driven when they went to Ghazni when I was there. Now, that said, in many cases, the downturn is a slide where there was very little to resist it. One should not exaggerate what has happened. I remember leaving Wardak late 2006 maybe and thinking to myself, we have nothing here. There are no foreign troops. There is no ANA, Afghan National Army, and there's about 150 or 200 police of dubious quality for the entire district, which has plenty of criminals. And so destabilizing this place would be really easy. And that's been true of several of the provinces. So I just say this not to mean it's good, just to say that pushing back some of these things isn't necessarily all that impossible. It does not indicate massive forces, but it's going wrong. Afghans see road security worse. They see the provinces around Kabul worse. This calls to their mind what they've seen before with the Mujahideen, with the fighting against the Soviets, a constriction strategy. And so they say to themselves, been here, seen this, done this. I know how this ends. The foreigners go home, and it all goes to hell. That is not a popular viewpoint which rallies people to sacrifice and support the government. And building them a better road or a better chicken coop is not going to turn that view around if they feel they're not going to survive indulging in the chickens. So now what are we going to do about all this stuff? The courts, by the way, are miserable. What strikes me as one looks at a great deal which is being written these days, when all of a sudden Afghanistan has been rediscovered to the extent that editors seem interested in publishing the papers people want to write about it, is that there is a very large degree of uniformity about what needs to be done. I haven't tried to tabulate it, but it's probably somewhere in the 80% to 90%. We need to work on the justice system. We've got to do a little better on security. Afghan governance has to be better. I mean, this is a rather familiar litany. And I would say that the reason there is so much overlap in the ideas is because most of these ideas are self-evidently right. What most of the discussions are leaving out is how you do it. And the implementation part is extremely important, and it gets very little discussion. What do I mean by implementation? Well, some of you may be old enough to have heard of Aesop's fable of the mice. They had a conclave to decide how to deal with the threat from the cat, and the decision was that they should put a bell on the cat so they would know when it was coming. That's policy. One stubborn old mouse asked, who's going to put the bell on the cat? That's implementation. That policy has never been implemented. Dates from about 6th century B.C. So a lot of what is written is not wrong, and some of it is even implementable, but it ends with the sort of do this, do that policy refrain, which is all not always so helpful. Take justice, for example. There is no question the justice system in Afghanistan is rotten. Now, on the one hand, you can say there's a fair amount of progress from the stand-up of efforts, lead nations. We have moved finally to a period last year where you had three major reform plans for the Justice Ministry, the Prosecutor's Office, and the Supreme Court, which were written by the Afghans rather than by foreigners, which were proposed at an international conference, which have now been accepted, which in Paris at Afghan request were rolled into an Afghan-led plan, for which a fair amount of additional money has been pledged by the international community. And in addition, there are, I think, 6 or 8 regional judicial centers which are being stood up rather slowly. The U.S. is funding 3 of them. The effort is being led by the U.N. All these are steps in the right direction. Their impact on the ground is zero. The funding is coming very slowly. Only the World Bank and a few other institutions can make the United States look rapid. Very few people have yet been trained under it. I don't want to knock these things, because within what the international community can do and bring to the process, these are steps in the right direction. And over the long term, they can make a difference. But the other piece of the puzzle is massive corruption within the society and in the judicial branch, and the accelerated killing of judges. So when you take judges that are poor and now they have a short life expectancy, taking a bribe looks even better. We've built some 60 courthouses, but I don't know how many of them are being used. And frankly, we probably might be just as important to build houses, because, you know, judges don't feel like they have a lot of respect and status when they live in a mud hut. and get $60 a month. Now, that's a piece that the Afghans are going to have to take on. There is going to have to be a different kind of political will to clean that up. That gets into the basic question of fairness. Now, this is not going to be easy. I want to linger on this for a minute because I don't have good news for you, but I want to talk about the how, because if people do not understand the complexities, they spend a lot of time railing at the issue, and then they get frustrated and want to go home. And they want to go home because they can't do what they never could do to begin with, and now they're unhappy about it. This is a sort of childish reaction to which we are sometimes prone. We are in our own electoral season. I don't find it particularly surprising that a weak president with very few resources is not prepared to take fundamentally larger gambles than, say, John McCain talking about the Republican base, where his campaign seems to have moved to a certain degree. President Karzai lives in a world where he has learned to depend on a certain number of traditional actors. Now, that's the environment in which he learned to survive and to govern for all his adult life. When you got the calculation wrong, you know, people died, like his father getting assassinated in the street. I think we're not going to get him to make a strategic decision to break out of his entire life context, nor would he have many followers if he did so. So what can the foreigners do about helping political will? You know, at the end of the day, there is a point beyond which we cannot create something if it doesn't exist. But we can work to build it. One of the things we will have to do is decide what very few things we want and work on those. We talk a lot about priorities. When you're talking about asking a man or a few men to make very difficult and sometimes even dangerous decisions in their own society, it's really important to focus on one thing at a time. Afghanistan is not a place that runs by rules. You know, first you negotiate to have an agreement, then you negotiate to implement it, and then you work, take one piece of the implementation and you work to get it right, and then you take the next piece. And there's a lot of stuff on the ground that has nothing to do with policy. To do that effectively, it means you have to work on more or less one thing at a time. And we, the foreigners, as well as we, the Americans, are very bad at this. We talk about priorities, but we really mean we want a list of everything we want, and we want to move on a lot of it at one time. We are very good. Actually, we can do nothing for a very long time, and we can decide to do something. We have a terrible time deciding not to do something, you know, deciding that something that is really important will not be taken to the president this month or maybe next month because you need something else more is for us excruciatingly difficult. And it's even more difficult when you have to do it in a multinational surrounding. But that is one of the things we have to do. If we want change, we have to be very careful about what we want it on, and then we have to focus on that thing. Now, the security piece I want to come back to for a minute because that's dominating the electoral discussion here, and it is part of security. First thing to understand is there is no surge in Afghanistan under discussion. We have about 20% of the troops we have in Afghanistan that we have in Iraq. We are discussing moving that from something like 20% of the number to, you know, somewhere around 30% plus or minus, depending how many troops go in. So you will now have one-third the troops you have in Iraq, but you have them in a country which is bigger, more populous, rougher terrain, with less unity of command and fewer support assets. That is not a surge. That is a marginal reinforcement to prevent disaster. Secondly, foreign forces are needed, but they're needed as a shield. They're needed to buy time to do other things. They are not an answer, a solution. They're not a road to victory. They're a road to preventing defeat. clearly the Afghan army is going to have to be enlarged. We're already making those decisions. But we have not found the trainers to go with that decision, and without that, we will not be very effective. It's important for people to understand that if you make all the right policy decisions this year, new administration comes in the door, more troops, more money, bigger army, nothing is going to be different in the fighting this summer, because very few of those troops will have gotten there. The equipment won't have been bought. The troops will barely be recruited, let alone trained, and they will not be in the battlefield. So we need to be very clear about what this year is. This year is a year of holding and hopefully preparing for a follow-on year. It's not a year in which you're going to turn things around. Don't have to like that, but that's probably about the best. The Afghans have to get through an election in 2009. Radical social change going into an election is not very likely. People don't tend to make large numbers of their political followers unhappy at one time. I think we should push for some things on the justice sector, on the governance sector. We certainly have to push for better security, and that's going to take a lot more people on the ground. It's going to take, ultimately, it takes a lot more Afghans. That's really how you get away from the civilian casualty problem. Not so much because you kill fewer civilians, it's because it's a different dimension when they get killed by Afghans as opposed to getting killed by Americans or American bombers. I personally have doubts about how fast a police force can emerge, which leads me to believe the Army is going to have to be even a good deal larger than we are already proposing for the expansion. I think historically far more rebellions, insurgencies have fallen to mass than to doctrine and technique. So there is going to have to be a review. Clearly there has to be a Pakistani peace. That isn't really our subject for today, and I don't want to give another lecture because you're all being very patient about this one, but I would simply make the point that we really need to think in terms of two policies. We need a regional policy which has a strong Pakistani peace, and we need an Afghan policy that is resourced on the basis that the Pakistani part may fail. Because, frankly, we have no idea whether it will succeed. And we, under great budgetary pressure, will have a terrible amount of desire to move pieces back and forth between the Afghan piece and the Pakistani piece, or to short fund both because we're doing things in both sides. And we're, you know, that is a way to disaster. Political programs can be managed at the margin. Military programs need to be heavily over-resourced for victory. There is waste in war. The alternative is usually to lose. Fine resourcing gives you no margin for, not only no margin for victory, it gives you no margin for surprise. And this is a part of the world that is famous for its ability to deliver surprises. So we will need to continue to work on building the technical competency of Afghans to deliver. I think we should move more money through Afghan sources. But to do this, we have to change. This is, try to make this last thing so we can get on to questions. Sorry, get on to Arnaud first, then get on to questions. I have faith that you'll have your 10 minutes no matter when I stop. We have what I would call an operational hole on the civilian side of our endeavors. We have resourced the military, and we have learned. We have learned a great deal, but we have not applied our lessons on the civilian side, so that we do not put enough aid people in the field to run programs, and we don't give them the authority to contract. And we have not dealt with the fact that if you want to push a lot of money to Afghan government sources and NGOs and do it rapidly, then you have to take a somewhat higher risk of failure. But because otherwise there's a tension between moving it rapidly and using training Afghan NGOs and things by programming and wanting complete fiscal oversight. So if you insist, particularly through contractor mechanisms, that they have a low rate of failure, you will ensure that they have a very slow rate of implementation. because they won't take chances. So they'll want spreadsheets and they want all these things. So you need to look at your authorities. You need to look at your risk management, which is a policy issue. You need to put enough people in the field. You need to put them at the field level in AID. I mean, it's ridiculous. We have 26 provincial reconstruction teams now. We have one state and one aid officer in, I think, 23. That's, or maybe it's 24 now. That means with the best luck in the world, we'll have a person there 10 months out of 12 with transfers and leaves. That's not a serious way to fight a war. We are, I believe, General Fields just come back. He can tell me if I got that wrong, but I believe we are starting a program of using National Guardsmen to run an agricultural development program in Nangarhar and some parts of the south. And it'll probably work pretty well because we've got people out of farming states with a good background. But we are misusing a scarce military resource to cover a civilian gap that we are incompetent to fill because we won't resource it. We don't have enough people to give proper supervision at AID, where AID is staffed to be a mission that implements projects, but we want them to do crisis response, implementation, and a constant strategic oversight to redirect the plan. That takes a different level, numbers of senior people. We don't have that. And we rotate people every year so that, you know, once a year we have the institutional equivalent of a frontal lobotomy. This is not a serious way to deal with the problem. So, you know, there are a big bunch of these pieces that have to be done by Afghan government, Afghan political will. We have to work on that. We have to push that. But there are a whole set of pieces that the international community and we ourselves have to do better and differently at what I would call the operational level in order to discharge policy well. And if we do not do these things, as we have continued not to do them for some years, then we will implement badly whatever policies the next administration chooses, really quite irrespective of what they are. So, you know, we have a problem. It's not going well. There's a lot to work with. Not going well, some people say we're losing the war. Well, okay. You know, if you asked in 1942, we were losing that war by any objective analysis. It doesn't, I don't mean we'll win that one, this one, because we won that one. Just that it doesn't tell you very much. We have a lot to work with. Afghans don't like the Taliban. They're afraid of it. More of them are more afraid of it now than they were last year, and more were afraid last year than the year before. But popular support for it has not really gone up. Support for the government's gone down. We're still reasonably popular. A great many Afghans recognize this as the last chance they've got. And feel that there is really no future if this operation doesn't work. We are still much more popular than we are in Iraq. We have vast resources in America and the West. We have a comparatively weak military movement, vastly weaker for all its strengths than the insurgency we confronted and are confronting in Iraq. So we have a lot of work to do, and we may not succeed, but we have no reason at all to be hopeless about things. Thank you very much.
We're now going to hear the good news.
Well, first let me correct you about the wars since World War II. I started as a journalist in 1946. There have been 260 wars and revolutions in the world since then.
And you've only made 18 of them.
That's right. It's a very small number.
I feel really bad about making only four.
I know that institutional memories are very short in Washington, so no one can possibly remember what happened at the time of President Kennedy's assassination. There were 16,500 American troops in South Vietnam that had been turned from advisors into fighting soldiers by the recommendations of General Maxwell Taylor before President Kennedy was killed. So then we sort of struggled along with small increments up until 546,000. And we had the Tet Offensive, and then the unraveling of the whole thing. I find all of this very strangely reminiscent of what we seem to be going through in Afghanistan with our two candidates suggesting that we should transfer troops from Iraq into Afghanistan, which in my judgment is throwing good money after bad. The The outgoing NATO commander has said that we need about 400,000 troops to hack it in this country that is the size of France or Texas. The British ambassador in Kabul and the British commander in Afghanistan have both said that this is an unwinnable war. Unless we're prepared to commit money and troops for the next 10 years, and even then I think it would be highly dubious that we would achieve our objectives even after 10 years. There are only three nations that are involved there in terms of fighting besides the United States, and that's the Netherlands, Canada, and the UK. The others, as you know, have had caveats imposed upon them by their national parliaments that they are to be restricted to peacekeeping and not get involved in peacemaking. And even those who are involved in harm's way today have been told by their national parliaments that they're out of there after 2 years, 2 years from now. The German Bundestag voted a few weeks ago 641-1 against enlarging the mandate of German forces in Afghanistan. They have also had a recent public opinion poll that shows that 9 out of 10 Germans would like to see their troops back as quickly as possible. Despite all of this, Chancellor Merkel announced in the last 24 hours that they were going to try to increase their troops from 3,500 to 4,500. I think she understands how much is at stake there for NATO if they can't pull it off. Well, mercifully, there are some enlightened friends who are riding to the rescue. I don't know how much of you know that prior to the Taliban regime, there were three countries, prior to the American invasion on October 7th, 2001, there were three countries that recognized the Taliban regime, that's Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Pakistan. Saudi Arabia has been very actively involved in trying to bring about some kind of reconciliation between the government in Kabul and Taliban. There was a meeting in Saudi Arabia last month. High-level delegation from Taliban, including their former foreign minister, a man I met in Kandahar in the summer of 2001, Waki Wakil, who was part of the delegation in Mecca. It was 3 days of talks last month in Mecca. They then moved on to have three more days of talks in Islamabad. The man behind all of this, who engineered all of this, is Prince Turki Al Faisal, who was head of the Saudi intelligence service for 26 years. Resigned about 3 weeks before 9/11. When I first heard about this off the record, when he was last in Washington 3 months ago, I suggested that maybe they were trying to displace U.S. influence and get Saudi Arabia to move in with Nawaz Sharif, their man, the contender for the prime ministership in Pakistan, the rival of Asif Zardari. That all of this was done, I suggested to Turkey, to displace U.S. influence. He said, not at all. It's to be complementary to U.S. influence, and I really don't see how the United States could possibly bring about some kind of reconciliation between Kabul and the Taliban. Part of this deal would be the Taliban would ignore Al-Qaeda, not only ignore Al-Qaeda, but sign a formal undertaking, a treaty, denouncing any connection with Al-Qaeda, that Al-Qaeda was to be pushed aside. I already got those feelings, incidentally, when I was in Kandahar 3 months before 9/11 with my Pakistani team to interview Mullah Omar. There were already suggestions then that Osama bin Laden could conceivably be sent out of the country to a neutral Muslim country to be put on trial by a religious court. They were quite open to those sorts of negotiations at that time, so I'm not surprised by the news that I hear from Prince Turki. I think that's about all I wanted to give you so that we could get going on the discussion. This is news that I'm sure very few of you are familiar with, so perhaps we could take it from there. And I could ask the ambassador if you think that that kind of a deal would be acceptable to the United States as a way of getting out from under the Afghan mess.
My turn. It might be. We use this term negotiation sometimes, I think, too broadly, and I think we have to define the term. If one is talking about some form of bringing people into more or less the existing political system. I think we're pretty receptive to that. If one is, and I think there are a fair number of people fighting who might be brought in, although probably a lot better chance of that if we were doing better in the fighting and the political, the military political balance was different. If one is talking about tearing up the arrangements of Bonn and having a negotiated sharing of power in some wholly new arrangement, then I'm pretty sure we would not back it. I think it would, even rumors of that on the one district in Musakala set off the most incredible political reverberations throughout Afghanistan and fear, particularly throughout all of the non-Pashtun areas, in which people immediately began to say, where do I get a gun? And so, first of all, I think we would oppose it. Secondly, I think a very large number of Afghans would oppose a power-sharing deal. And third, I think one has to at least look with some considerable question at whether a deal like that, if arranged, would hold, given the record of negotiations and fighting which went back and forth in the period from the fall of the Najibullah government to the Mujahideen, to the Taliban versus Mujahideen, to our victory. I mean, the whole record of Afghan negotiations, deals, and betrayals suggests the instability of a peace based on, you know, you can have this piece of land and I have this piece and now we're all going to be buddies. So I think there is a lot of scope to bring people in, and could be more, and we could work that a lot better than it has been worked by both Afghans and by us.
It seems to me that, if I, you don't mind me interrupting at this point, it seems to me that we are in a position of losing long-term or even short-term in Afghanistan, as it was going very badly for us in Vietnam, too, and negotiations started. They took a long time. They took 2 years, and a coalition government was agreed. It was even supposed to be a three-party coalition, which fell apart in October of 1972, which led to the Christmas bombing, and then finally succeeded on January 23rd, 1973. So the same kind of scenario is not inconceivable in Afghanistan.
Yeah, but you extend the scenario and you find you lose by a different path. So, I mean, the political attractiveness of losing long-term through negotiation is not necessarily overwhelming.
But is the difference here between a strategy for getting out as opposed to a strategy for winning? Is that what we're looking at?
Obviously, since you now have some rather influential and authoritative voices, the British ambassador in Kabul and the British commander saying that this is unwinnable, and the NATO commander saying it requires about 400,000 troops.
Yeah, I am not surprisingly not quite going to agree. That's okay. That's what makes discussions interesting. But I am highly unimpressed by the British comment.
That itself is a British comment.
Form and style are one thing, substance is something else. But I do not want to exacerbate Allied relations by entering into detail. But the fact is that the British have not done brilliantly in Helmand, and there has been a lot of strain with the Afghan government. And some of it is the fault of the Afghan government, no question. And some of it has been produced by the tactics and approach. And I think I want to leave it there, except to say that I do not find that source nearly as authoritative as others might.
We had a high-ranking Afghan official in Washington a few months ago who was in charge of narcotics, and It was an off-the-record conversation, but he thought it was on the record, and he started to tell us how well he was doing, and the opium poppies were finally getting under control. And I interrupted him, and I said, Mr. Minister, I know an American official who happens to speak your language. He also speaks Pashto and Urdu. He's frequently in Kabul, and he tells me that every minister is on the take, and sometimes not number one directly, but number three or number two, and it moves up to number one, and that they all have their U.S. visas up to date in case they have to get out quickly. He then said, oh, I thought we were on the record. I said, no, Mr. Minister, we're off the record. He said, in that case, everything you've just said is true.
We should open this up, but there is a difference here between the objectives, right? It seems to me that one objective is how do you get out of there, and that's a different, that's going to be a different set of steps than if your objective remains to win there in some way or other, or to help the Afghans win. Please.
I'm Mitzi Wirth. I'm with CNA. I'm really puzzled by the language of winning and victory. And as long as that's an objective, I'd like to know what it looks like. And I guess I'm inclined to agree with Sherrod. I mean, I, along with you, think he's a very bright guy who really knows that part of the world well.
Yeah, my derogatory comment was addressed much more to the military commander. I don't agree with Sherrod either, but one will have to talk about it. Our political will may give out. That's perfectly possible. Consequences for that are very severe, and none of the proposed solutions deal with any of the consequences. That's the real problem. Fragmentation, reemergence of Al-Qaeda, strategic rear, in a sense, for growing extremism in Pakistan if they're able to reimplant in Afghanistan. The trouble is that between losing and negotiating, I don't see a lot of difference in the consequences. And I was puzzled by the Canard Enchaîné report of his conversation saying we need to turn it over to a dictator, since I cannot imagine who that – there is no one power center. There is – no large military. There is absolutely no one on the scene who can fulfill that role anytime soon. So if that's the analysis for an alternative, then that doesn't say a lot to me about the expertise in the area. Who the hell has he got in mind that fills that bill? That was your second piece. I think my definition, I won't tell you that there's a U.S. government one, so I'm not sure there is quite simply a government which has a broad enough popular base of support to sustain itself in a prolonged conflict, albeit with a certain measure of foreign support. It's not a 21st century liberal democracy. It doesn't necessarily include everything we want in religious freedoms, gender freedoms, perfect democracy, but it has a broad enough base of support to sustain itself. I don't know if that can be done. It's been a very long, there hasn't been such a government. It may be impossible to create. There is a lot of history to say that it's not possible. But if it is not, then it really doesn't matter in what form we lose, because in the absence of another power center, you either build something which has enough roots to survive, or you fragment. And I don't see a third course. Sherwood was, as quoted, describing a third course which seems to me to rest on phantasmagorical grounds. Ain't nobody to fill it.
Anything is possible today, Ambassador. Last night on cable television, they showed a rerun of that famous 1967 classic Bonnie and Clyde, and doesn't that remind you of what we're watching on cable news every day now? And we also see, it seems to me, other nations are now following George Bush's lead in dismantling what seems to be the structures of democratic free market capitalism, and we're moving slowly towards socialism. So again, anything is possible.
So we could win.
Absolutely.
Hi, thank you. I'm Karen Von Hippel here at CSIS. I just returned on Monday from about a week in Afghanistan. And Ambassador, is this working? Okay, sorry. You mentioned that we all agreed on what needs to be done, but I guess my question is, it's not just about what needs to be done, but I felt that there wasn't really clarity on the bigger questions, like how do you bring in the Taliban? What do you do about drugs? Do you work at the center or do you work at the periphery if you're promoting governance? So I guess that was my larger question, is how do you answer these larger questions?
First of all, when I said there was a lot of agreement, what I was talking about was the policy prescriptions you see in journal and academic articles at the moment, a great deal of which is being written, and there you see a lot of overlap in fix the judicial system, fix corruption, sort of fix big things. They don't, not only don't they agree, they don't propose in most cases how you answer the question you just raised. My own answer is that a lot of that has to be sorted out on the ground by people there, that most of what is written about better comprehensive strategies is, I think, a mirage because of the nature of multinational operations, because I've never seen a case in which you can get a strategy at a level of detail that actually tells you what 36 troop contributors or 60-odd economic donors will actually do about any particular thing on any particular strategy. So I think you have to break off, and this is not a very satisfactory answer, by the way, but I think it is the practical one. I think you break off pieces and you bring together the actors. Let me give you, for instance, we had an issue of dealing with energy policy. Everybody tends to reflect backwards, so you got to go forward, but I'm just using this for an example, where we felt that we needed some changes in policy and we needed better coordination, and we ended up doing a paper for discussion, which we circulated through UNAMA. They took ownership of it. We then brought together the ambassadors from the major, or heads of party, from the relevant folk, which was myself, the German, the Indian, World Bank representative, Asian Development Bank representative, because we were the ones building the power line from the north. We got a common position agreed. We then spent about 6 months getting some major changes done with the Afghans. We didn't solve everything by any means, but we did identify gaps in policy. We did close some of the gaps. We were able to start a more and remain on a more unified line. I think that is going to have that kind of piece by piece, break off a piece, bring the actors together, settle it at the table, is going to have to be done much more extensively. You can have a nice mandate for Qaeda, but there is no mandate which commands international aid groups, still less the NGOs. We can work and should work on clarifying our own internal mandates. And I think they have just had some greater clarity in the military chain. But, you know, the British ambassador has no real authority over the head of DFID. You don't have one British policy that is uniform between aid and military. The German ambassador and the representative of the Interior Ministry that really controls the police and the German aid agency are all separate authorities. So in my mind, it is really quite pointless to talk about trying to have a top-down coordinator until we can get at least a single national coordinating point for countries. So the trouble is I don't have a good simple answer. I mean, I can go through a bunch of policies. I think we could do a lot more in Helmand if we start with where the counterinsurgency strategy and command thinks it's going to be in terms of territorial control and security a year from now, and then starts building backwards to say, what do you want to do about counter drug in the area you're going to have some control over? We tend to want to do these in a very airy-fairy fashion, where we describe something and then we try to figure out how we're going to implement it, and then we figure we can't implement a piece of it. And it doesn't go well. So there's a huge part of this that I think could go better, may not, with better implementation. But it's not about institutions. It's about people. It's about having the right folk on the ground.
I was going to ask you, the key problem to all of this is still the federally administered tribal areas, those seven tribal agencies between Afghanistan and Pakistan, where Taliban has privileged sanctuaries. And as long as they have privileged sanctuaries, I think you might concede that it's an unwinnable war.
Probably. There's also a larger question of what happens in Pakistan. I mean, that situation isn't. Got some better experts than I am to talk about Pakistan. But if, I guess the return question is, what does one wish to do about that? If we do nothing, there is now a increasing evidence of extremism growing out of the tribal areas. I don't know where that goes, but it does seem to me that there are some fundamental tensions in Pakistan, and that even, as you say, not winning, losing in Afghanistan, if you can't do it, does not necessarily solve your problem if that is expanding. So I guess I would put the question back, not rhetorically, but because I genuinely don't know, do you have serious concerns, to others who know more about Pakistan, about the long-term future of Pakistan? And I don't quite see how you have an articulated strategy to help the government of Pakistan deal with the tribal areas, or even Balochistan, assuming they wanted to, at the same time that you declare basically a strategy of pulling out of Afghanistan and having an Afghan victory. I mean, this is not a lot of encouragement for somebody to have a more articulated strategy in the frontiers.
I think political forecasting and economic prognostication about Pakistan have made astrology look respectable.
No, thank you. But I do want to thank both Ron and Arno. I wonder if you would refine your suggestions and recommendations in light of three critical issues. The first is obviously the economic crisis, which could be truly catastrophic. And if it is, all this talk about money anywhere in the United, globally, you're talking about billions of dollars, and it's just not going to be there. So what might be the effects of an economic meltdown on not just the military side, but also on the civil side? Second, and Ron, you raised the issue of Pakistan. Some would argue the situation in Pakistan is more dire. The Pakistan army is exhausted. It's not prepared for the insurgency it's facing. The insurgency is getting worse, and Pakistan is about ready to run out of money to cover its foreign deficits. Under those circumstances, what can be done in terms of having a joint regional strategy, because Pakistan and Afghanistan are intertwined? And thirdly, both Senators McCain and Obama have pledged to increase troops in Afghanistan and have said almost nothing about the civil sector side, which is where the battle is going to be joined or lost. It's going to be at least 6 months or a year before the next administration is up and running. Is that going to provide an opportunity or a further default to make the situation worse because of the absence of American policy strategy and a functioning administration?
Let me start, but I want to let Arno have chances as well on this, clearly. Going in reverse order, the chances are it will get worse because of the problem any new administration has of standing up. I hope it is not so. I hope they're studying deeply. I hope they know what they want to do. But we have at best, we have a very long flash to bang time. I mean, even if they come in the door with a policy, if it requires money, that has to be gotten from the Congress. Troops, they can move. At a minimum, assuming you're not going to quit and go home, we really need to speak honestly about that with the American people. Otherwise, I think you simply create a perception of – you pre-create the perception of failure, because you announce things and then 6 months or 9 months later, nothing has happened because the things you announce haven't really had any effect, and everybody decides the policy is a failure. Policy may fail, but that's a separate issue. If you're not – open and honest about the very long lead time, then you tend to be damned for the failure you haven't yet had a chance to achieve, which might even be avoided. I think you ought to be giving the lecture on what to do about Pakistan falling down. That's much more your terrain than mine. I will hazard a thought, but I think really you and Arno and others who've dealt more with Pakistan than I need to comment. It does seem to me that policy cannot wholly be made in Washington, that there needs to be a period of serious discussion in which, with a combination of potential rewards and potential threats not necessarily excessively exercised, one sees if there is a ground for agreement between us, Pakistani army, and Pakistani civilians on a single policy. I don't know enough to know what their own ideas are. I mean, if they don't believe they face an existential threat, then I'm not sure whether we can find the means to persuade them to take the kind of risks you're talking about in the situation you're talking about. But I don't know what their own evaluation of it is.
Harlan brings up a very important point about being broke, because Iceland, one of the most prosperous countries in the world, as you know today, has declared bankruptcy. We're not going to lend them any money, but they've turned to the Russians, who apparently are looking favorably on a $5 billion loan to Iceland. So right now it seems to me that any kind of forecasting of things that will require funding are impossible to make.
Yeah. You probably the right bottom line. I don't know the answer. I mean, it may just be impossible, in which case all the more complicated discussions are simple. We lose.
Hence the importance of the Saudi initiative, because they still have money and they have influence in Pakistan via their friend Nawaz Sharif, who spent 7 years in Saudi Arabia. And I think the Saudis are going to make a big play for influence in this Muslim country.
It will be interesting to see if it happens. They have been extremely quiet up to now.
The Saudis actually have been heavily involved in Pakistan in terms of cheap oil.
In Pakistan, yeah. Yes, I'm in that. In Afghanistan, they've been a minor aid donor and largely quiescent. Many of us used to encourage them to be more active. So this, there is always that, careful what you ask for.
Thank you, Yasmin Elmiri from the Saudi Press Agency. So I was just asking for a quick good timing. If I could just ask for a quick clarification on this initiative by the Saudis, and if the U.S., I didn't catch it, if the U.S. is backing it, because it seems like it wouldn't make sense for them to.
I have no idea whether the U.S. is backing it, because it all took place outside of the U.S.
Do they know about the meetings?
Oh, I'm sure they do. And if they don't, obviously somebody has to be replaced.
They do now.
I'm sorry, what is the initiative? What are
the Saudi initiative?
Yes, what are they asking for specifically?
Well, they're trying to get the government in Kabul and Taliban, so-called moderate elements of Taliban, to get together in some sort of coalition government that would end the war. And they had a three-day meeting in Mecca last month, and then that was followed immediately by another three-day meeting in Islamabad at a very high level on the Taliban side, since it was the former foreign minister of Taliban, Wayakikil, who was the head of the delegation. This would be a coalition government of sorts with moderate elements of Taliban.
Thank you. I'm David Hendrick with the CSIS Africa program. I have a question on General McKiernan's decision last week to announce that U.S. forces are now going to go after drug trafficking in Afghanistan. Can you both discuss the implications of this? Does this put us on a collision course with our allies? Is this a good decision to do this?
I have no idea what they decided, so I don't think I clarify anything by speculating in the range of.
All I've heard is that it was not a decision. It was a suggestion of a decision that was not taken, given the opposition of the allies.
Rather distressing, whatever I've heard. I was just wondering, if one were to assume that there is commitment to bring peace to the region, clearly the amount of resources that will require will be significant, much larger than has been committed so far. The resource commitments will have to be much larger than they have been so far. You can't fight this kind of a battle on the cheap. The question now is, the major industrial countries are not in a position to finance it. One thing is quite clear, that in as bad a situation as Afghanistan's, what we call it, what we economists call the incremental capital output ratio is very high. You have to spend a heck of a lot of money to get the minimum critical effort going. That means there will have to be multiples of increases in spending that will have to take place. There are only two surplus countries in the region, largely surplus countries in the region, or the regional countries which can finance it, and that's Saudi Arabia, the UAE on one side, and China on the other. Will there be a possibility? And in this case, it's very important to know what will be the quid pro quo if those countries were to come in and fund the massive amount of transfers that will have to take place.
Just a quick parenthetical note on the Saudi influence in...
answer the question.
Yes, but this helps answer the question, or illuminate the question.
Leave me to answer the question.
You're already catching on to my strategy. Yeah. Took you a long time. No, seriously, the Saudis already had a tremendous amount of influence in Taliban-governed or ruled Afghanistan. The head of a major madrasa university in the town of Katak, south of, Peshawar, they had people like Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar giving commencement addresses there in May of 2001. And the head of that university, Samiul Haq, told me that he journeyed to Saudi Arabia every other month to get his money. So this was already going on a very large scale. So Saudi influence in Pakistan has been around for a long time.
I can't really speculate. I mean, when you ask about a quid pro quo, I don't know what they would ask. I presume involvement would be based on their view of the strategic value of the region. I doubt you would have a lot of objection from us. The UAE has been comparatively active already, and we've certainly supported that very, very closely. You might have an issue on a policy, but we would certainly be supportive of the of greater Saudi involvement. And we were really pretty comfortable with, at least when I left, unless something's changed, with a greater degree of Chinese involvement, but the Chinese weren't very interested. They would do things for money, but they weren't doing a lot of pure aid or heavy investment. And I don't know whether that has changed since I left. So, you know, it's not at best a half answer to the question, but it's the only half I know.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. I read about this Saudi hosting of this meeting, but I'm puzzled. When people say moderate versus extreme Taliban, whom do the moderates represent? Whom can they control? Would they be able to overwhelm the extremists, supposedly? The Daily Times of Pakistan today has an editorial that points out the person representing Mullah Omar at these negotiations is Hekmat Yar, who they say not exactly a moderate, and I just wonder what kind of a coalition government could one envision? What ministries could one give to the Taliban? I just don't understand the arrangements.
I don't think anybody has reached that stage trying to figure out who gets which portfolio from which faction of Taliban and which faction of the current legal government of Afghanistan. All that's long in the future. I can't imagine this happening quickly. And I can't imagine anything happening until we know who's going to be the next president of the United States, who will then have to give it a push forward or hold it back.
To the various things one cannot imagine, I also can't imagine it working. But, you know, but I don't know what this is supposed to be about. On the other half of the question of this business of moderate Taliban, what I think, with no relevance to this particular initiative, but talking about terminologies. I think we use words like this. What we are groping for, or what people are groping for, is a way of capturing simply the fact that you have a spectrum or continuum of views within the insurgency. And you have a lot of people in it that are local and tribal. You have you have elements coming across the border with various, very different kind of ideologies. I remember several years ago we did an interrogation of a number of over 100 prisoners taken in the summer of 2006 in the South. Bad news was most of them, this was essentially your basic trigger puller, wasn't your leaders, most of them were local. The lead reasons that people gave for being in the fight when they were interrogated was tribal frictions, resentment of bad government, in some cases just money. Those are very different causes from the ideology that you find motivating senior Taliban leaders. And so I think in part when one talks about moderates, when he's talking about people who are not necessarily on an ideological spectrum, but whose reasons for being in the fight are quite different and who might be brought out of the fight by a combination of redressing grievance, safety from accountability for past wrongs, reintegration into the society. In most cases, I think when you actually get down below terminology and say who, what you are talking about is leaders of tribal factions or militia factions, not ideological components with whole movements behind them. There may be something more than that, but that's generally been my experience.
There are two names that I can give you in case you don't have them. One, leaders of the Taliban delegation in Mecca last month, Mohammed Agha, A-G-H-A, and the former foreign minister, a man I know well, Wakil Mutawakil, who was certainly considered a moderate in the movement. And incidentally, he spent some time in jail at Bagram Air Force Base, and I think has had plenty of time to get to know American interlocutors a little better than he did before.
Omar Sudki with the Near East South Asia Center. Ambassador Newman, earlier you stated that the U.S. needs to compile more than just a big list, but rather prioritize them and do them one at a time. Just curious to know if you were able to compile a list, what would be at the top, and how would you implement it?
Probably bearing down on various parts of the Ministry of Interior, because that's the second part of security which is working badly, and because it is one of the leading choices of Afghans when they want to talk about what's corrupt. And as awful as it is to improve that, it's probably relatively easier than producing honest judges in short term. I don't think you can only do one thing, but that would be... And I don't think one should fool oneself that bearing down hard might mean you do something in 3 years instead of in five. Maybe that's an optimistic projection. But it probably becomes about changing individuals more than producing an institution. In a decade, if we have not lost by that time, we might be talking about institutions. At this point, there are no real institutions. You're talking about people. The good news is when you have a strong person, whether it's a governor or a corps commander, you find quite a bit can go right in a local area. The ability to produce change is fairly high, maybe because of the bad situation you're starting from. But individuals make a lot of force. We write, it's interesting to me, that if you look at most of the writings on policy, they are almost exclusively about institutional change. In a situation in which we have almost no institutions, will take a very long time to produce them, in which the caliber of the individual is supremely important. I leave you to reflect on what this all means.
My name is Ahmed Mir. It seems to me that the definition of success for the U.S. in Afghanistan is not clear to either you people or the administration. And in that situation, the one thing that's very clear to anybody who knows the subcontinent and Pakistan and Afghanistan is whatever the U.S. does in Afghanistan and its relationship with Pakistan is going to blow up Pakistan, which is a much bigger country and where we do have some clear ideas of what we want. It seems to me that people who are addressing U.S. policy on Afghanistan have to honestly tell the administration and the public that they don't know anything about the situation and which way to go. I think you're criticizing the British general for making his statement. I don't think his statement is any different from what I hear here. You know, I mean, it may be a different way of saying it and what the British do, but institutionally, anybody who knows, again, that region knows that Afghanistan cannot be changed in a short time. I mean, it's such a different country. I mean, the level of education and the culture and so on. It just cannot be done in 10 years or more. I think we've got to come very honestly. I just don't understand with Mr. Obama and Mr. McCain talking about adding more forces. What does that mean? Are they just going to start bombing more and more and antagonize the region? Because people should say, I think it's even, I feel that it may even be better that we don't do anything and wait for these new president, whoever becomes the president, take his own sweet time. Because I think our actions are creating more problems rather than solutions. And I think we should expand the multilateral relationship. And don't stick to just Muslims and Saudis. Saudis don't have a great reputation. They may have it with some of the leadership in Pakistan and so on, but they don't have a positive reputation within the public. And I think the central problem, it seems, is across the board of that in that region, there is an anti-Americanism which is based on ignorance, which is based on some vision of what may be going on, but it's not based on real understanding. And we just add to it. So my feeling or reaction and the question, I don't know, this maybe I didn't want to make a statement. I did want to ask a question of Ambassador Newman because he is an important advisor, that, you know, well, I mean, Fatah was impossible to handle by the British ages ago. It seems we talk here across the board in all the newspapers and journals as if it can be handled. I mean, the discredit to the Pakistanis and Musharraf of not handling Fatah, I think, is sort of a little naive. I've only read British history. Maybe I haven't kept up so much with the politics of the region today. But I think Fatah is very difficult. And it seems to me the only definition of success for the U.S. would be to kill Osama. If we kill that, we'll forget everything. You know? It seems to me that's the only definition of success. Because none of the other things that you all talk about, I think, can be achieved.
I happen to agree with what you said, and I think what is terribly important to bear in mind is that the national security interests of Pakistan and the United States do not necessarily coincide. It was really driven home to me by the chief minister in Peshawar. They've now lost their elections. Last February 18th they lost, but before that you had two of Pakistan's four provinces governed by ministers who sympathized with Taliban. As a matter of fact, Chief Minister Durrani told me that he was a great admirer of Osama bin Laden and a personal friend of Mullah Omar, and he was governing an entire province at a time when we thought that Pakistan and the United States were very close allies.
Good afternoon. I'm Khalid Wardak. I'm an African-American, and yes, I'm from Wardak province. I just have two questions, two brief questions for Ambassador Newman. The first question is, as we all know, the security situation has been deteriorating, and the elections are supposed to be in the summer or in the fall time frame. Are the United States and the international community taking any steps to make sure that the elections go through, and do you think that they will go through? That's my first question. I can hold off for the answer. And my second question is, recently the Minister of Defense of Afghanistan made a recommendation to develop a joint coalition force along the border. So that will comprise of the Pakistani army, NATO, U.S. forces, and the Afghan army. Do you think Pakistan will agree to such an arrangement? Thank you.
I can talk better to the first. What I understand, remember, I'm not in the government anymore. I not only don't speak for it, I don't claim to be up to date, although I try. There has been a fair amount of work on preparations and the handling of the election registration process, which is now started. My understanding is that we are rather behind where we probably need to be on preparing for the election itself. I think it is still doable in the sense that I think it is less violent and less challenging than the Iraqi election of January 2005, which we were able to hold. But that's really a theoretical answer, which depends on early enough planning for money, foreigners, troops, resources to field what is necessary. What you're really talking about is whether you can produce enough security for a limited period of time to have a large enough vote in certain critical parts of the South and East where you might not otherwise have people come out, so that you have a vote that is respected by a Pashtun population as a legitimate outcome of the election. I don't think the rest of the country is so much in doubt, although you will need mechanisms to convince people that the election is honest, at least within a reasonable range. I think it is beginning to filter into consciousness that we need to do this, but I'm not sure that we're where we are. I may not be up to date. I don't actually know. I mean, there on the joint force, I have no idea whether the Pakistanis would be willing to do it. There's one level that's political calculation, and then there's a hugely complex world of implementation and putting the thing together and how you'd make it work, and very different levels of training. And even if you had political agreement, there are an awful lot of places where it could come off the track. So it's an interesting idea, but I don't know enough to say more than that.
It seems to me there's the beginning of a strategy is to understand that. I mean, strategy is a plan, it seems to me, by which resources are arrayed to reach objectives in the face of alternatives and problems. It seems to me there's four, and so you have to get the objectives clear. It seems to me there have been four that have been laid out here. One is that you would have a potential, or if not objectives, end states. One would be a coalition in which there would be no al-Qaeda, but there would be Taliban in the government, and the U.S. would get out. The second is that the U.S. would get out, there would be an Afghan government, but not a Taliban, without Taliban.
The U.S. and NATO.
U.S. and NATO, yeah, right. The third is that there would be a reasonable government, not necessarily the kind that you would like, but a reasonable government with reasonable legitimacy, reasonable stability, and no Taliban and no al-Qaeda. And the fourth is a reasonably successful state, one that would look, you know, pretty good. If you don't know which of those you're ready to settle for and how many resources you're prepared.
What was your second one?
The second one was an anti-Taliban, an Afghanistan without Taliban, but we're indifferent to what it looks like, just as long as there's no Taliban in it.
You'd hope there'd be a strong man.
Well, we'd be indifferent. I mean, that's one possibility. That's a possible outcome. We're indifferent as long as there is an anti-Taliban or non-Taliban government. And what it does and how it does it and how it operates, we don't really care so much about because, after all, we went in there because of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. So the first is no Al-Qaeda. The second is no Taliban. The third is no Taliban and no Al-Qaeda, but really not a very successful state. And the fourth is a really successful state. How those objectives are aligned with resources seems to me to be kind of a whether you could achieve the latter two, and at what resource cost. It seems to me you have to figure all that out before you know whether you're succeeding, failing, what you're willing to settle for, what resources would require you to get to the better state rather than the less good state.
Jerry, it seems to me that all of this is pretty academic until we know who's going to be the next president of the United States.
Does that really, I mean, between them, they didn't really, but in between these four alternatives, there was not a lot of daylight between Senator Obama and Senator McCain last night. None of them suggested anything other than the fourth one.
That's because they still don't know very much about Afghanistan. Wait until they get into office, and then they will be briefed as to what's really happening.
Thank you. My name is Ahmed Majidiar from American Enterprise Institute. My question is about the reports that we see in the media and also stated repeatedly by the Afghan and NATO officials in Afghanistan about the economic and also military support that the Taliban have been receiving from Iran recently, especially over the past 2 years. My question is that whether the support comes from any Iranian government entity or is it more of a smuggling business along the border regions? And if it is the latter, not the former, how can we believe that such big shipments of weapons, for example, last year in April, a 10-ton cache of weapons was intercepted, which makes it difficult to surmise that it could be without the knowledge of the Iranian government entities there. So do you think that this comes from the government, or is it more of smuggling business? Thank you.
I have no idea, sir, in this particular instance, but I do remember that when we first went into Afghanistan on October 7th, 2001, it only took 410 men to liberate Afghanistan at that time, and the Iranians were very helpful, and so were the Russians. And I submit to you that we may need the Iranians again, and that this should be part of the negotiation, which I think is inevitable with Tehran, unless we are going to go for the bombing option, which would blow up the entire Middle East.
I have some experience with this, although I'm a little out of date now. The Iranians were very helpful at the beginning, as Mr. Dvorshkov says. The weapons shipment of which I have knowledge were never clearly sourced to the Iranian government, but were, in my judgment, too frequent and too large to be a completely accidental endeavor. They clearly picked up, as our relations with Iran and the threat of military action increased. And it was also clear that there was a great deal less coming in than was going into Iraq. So there was not only a question of what was coming in, but there was the question of motivation. If they were doing things, why were they not doing much more, which they were capable of doing? There may be some intelligence piece now of which I'm blissfully unaware, so I don't have to be silent or devious about it. My own analysis, and I stress that it is my own, it is not, you know, revealing some fact, is that as the threat of potential military action from the U.S. got worse, the Iranians have warmed up various ties with various nefarious parties who they might want to use if they need allies in asymmetrical warfare and striking back, and that they've done what they needed to do or are doing what they need to do to keep those ties warm. They're not mistaking them for an alliance, and they may have some belief that they are signaling us that they could make things a great deal worse. Whether or not they are intending to signal and whether or not we are getting the signal are both, I think, unknown quantities, the history of later investigation of supposed signaling between countries reveals that most of it is either missed or misunderstood. So I'm not going to speculate too far on that. But I think I would guess that what you have is a combination of keeping alive ties that might be useful. It doesn't tell you anything about motivation in the long term. It does not contradict or in any way argue against the point just expressed that we ought to talk to them.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ambassador Neumann and Mr. Dobrushkov. It was very, it was a great pleasure to listen to you, indeed. And I'm Hussein Ergan, I'm from the Turkish Embassy. And I couldn't stop myself to share some of my observations concerning Afghanistan because I just arrived from Afghanistan on a one-year mission. I think the biggest problem there is the outreach to the people, I mean Afghan people, because they are suffering a lot. During the Taliban regime, they suffered a lot. And afterward, I mean, when the international community came in and with the great might, they had great expectations that a lot of things would change. And having said that, and coming to this period when we discussed whether this strategy, all these things were successful, the international campaign was successful, we can easily observe that it was not, indeed. And that's why we are here and we are discussing the strategy again and again. And this outreach issue, indeed, I mean, in when you go to Afghanistan and when you are in Kabul, you can easily see that the international community there, they're just they're disconnected with Afghan people. I mean, they live in heavily guarded, armored vehicles or headquarters. They had limited facilities to go and talk to people. And this is the dichotomy between security and development. And if you don't have security, it's very difficult to take civilians, development agents to the ground and to have development activities to be done. So in the, from this perspective, I think it was the understanding to have security and development together, and most of the strategies included these two. I mean, to have security and development hand in hand. Whenever you go and provide security somewhere, then you also bring development activities to win people. But it's not all the time, of course, possible to do that. And as I understand, it was a great failure of international community so far, and it will be difficult unless there is this linkage, I mean, between the international development agencies and with the Afghan people. And it is also, of course, no question has an easy answer in Afghanistan context. It's a complex question. Maybe in each case, we have to have a tailor-made approach. I mean, depending on the province, even sometimes depending on specific tribes. But of course, it requires huge resources, huge attention, huge interest, and maybe more. But I don't believe, you know, having a greater military force there, it is going to again solve the problem. That's the thing. And just also, I have a question because I recently hear from Secretary of Defense Gates, I read the report, his statement to the press, I think. He was saying the Afghan strategy would be revised. It's not confirmed yet, but I think there is such a possibility in the coming days we can see. What should be the new strategy in Afghanistan in this case? And should this strategy also include this talking with insurgency there? Thank you.
Really quick. By the way, thank you for your efforts, and I visited your PRT in Wardak and was very happy with him. I believe what is going on now is a two-part sort of review. It is a review, but there is very little left in time in this administration. So what can be done is almost nothing.
Transition teams are doing
it. But the transition teams will also be doing a review. The administration will hand off views to the transition, whoever wins. But it will be probably in the form of choices rather than, you know, here's what to do. And I think it's going to take some while, as we discussed earlier. I would have guessed that that would have all the, not necessarily satisfactory, I don't mean that, but it will address development security. But I don't expect that you're going to see anything very large decided until after January.
Well, it's commonplace to say this has been a really interesting discussion, but I think this really has been greatly frank and illuminating, at least to me. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much for doing this.
Thanks,